know, every year for the past decade, I've invited author and businessman Craig R. Smith to give me the latest and greatest insight on the economy, the markets, and also to explain for you his latest book. For example, in 2011, we explored the inflation deception, which exposed today's inflatocracy that we called, quote, a new form of government that deliberately debases its paper money for social engineering, mind manipulation, wealth redistribution, secret taxation, and seizing more power. In 2012, we discussed the Great Debasement, which explained the century-long monetary destruction resulting from fractional reserve banking and how stocks and the U.S. dollar, pumped up by trillions in Fed stimulus money, would first inflate and then deflate. Last year, we covered the Great Withdrawal, which tore the mask off progressive politicians like Obama. We discussed our modern crisisocracy, creating and exploiting every crisis, launching a great cultural withdrawal from citizenship, unions, banks, and even the workforce itself. Listeners, today we are discussing something that affects all of you, our brave new banking world, in which everything is becoming hackable, trackable, and taxable. In Craig's new book, Don't Bank on It, The Unsafe World of 21st Century Banking, he unmasks modern banking to reveal banks we trust to safeguard our money are now one of the riskiest places to put it. The symbol of bank security has been the safe, says the book's back cover. Today it should be the unsafe, because your bank deposits are now in danger in at least 20 major ways, from cyber criminals, money-hungry politicians, too-big-to-fail bankers, and those now stealing your dollar's value, including the dollars you thought were secure inside your bank vaults. Craig, welcome back to the Savage Nation. Let's get right to it. Over a century ago, Henry Ford summarized modern banking saying, "It is well enough that people of the nation do not understand our banking and monetary system, for if they did, I believe there would be a revolution before tomorrow morning." Craig, is this lack of understanding our money and banking system, which Henry Ford spoke of, what prompted you to write Don't Bank on It? Are we on the cusp of a new economic revolution?
Michael, it really was a lot of the purpose for writing Don't Bank on It. You see, I am thoroughly convinced after studying this for 35 years that the American people really don't understand our banking and money system. As Henry Ford said, if they did, there would be a riot or a revolution before 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. And the truth be told, most people don't understand how the banking system works, how you put $1 in a bank, they end up creating $10 worth of credit, they issue $10 worth of debt, that debt is used like money, and how the system perpetuates itself. And yet, really, credit and debt is not money. Money has to be portable, divisible, it has to be a store of value, and it has to be scarce. And of course, when we can do QE1 and QE2 and QE3, and I think soon to be QE4 and QE5 and QE forever, we can create trillions upon trillions upon trillions of dollars, if you will, that ultimately become expressed in the form of debt and credit. You know, credits and debits create balance sheets. And so I think that most American people don't understand it, and that's why we are on the cusp of a new economic revolution, in so much as that if people understood what was happening to the money that they labor 40, 50 hours a week for, and how over the long term it's losing its buying power, it's not gaining its buying power, we will see an economic revolution. I mean, there were periods in American history where your U.S. dollar actually bought you more goods and services on the long-term periods. There were times when we had deflation. You see, deflation is, in my mind, great for savers. Think about it. If you put $100 away, and that's your electric bill every month, and next month, because of deflation, your electric bill is only $75, that's a very positive thing. But the economic system that we've developed today in America depends upon inflation, and as a direct result of that, it works against savers and favors borrowers. And that's why we have a nation that's steeped $17 trillion in short-term debt, $127 trillion in long-term liabilities. That's why there's trillions upon trillions upon trillions of dollars of debt internationally. It's why you have $710 trillion worth of derivative exposure in the market. And so, yeah, I think, Michael, we are on the cusp of an economic revolution. And unfortunately, like all revolutions, it's better after it occurs, but the process running up to and going through a revolution is normally pretty uncomfortable. And unfortunately, a lot of people get hurt. In some cases, they die. and leave it to our politicians to always make sure that the people that get hurt the worst are the middle class. And that's the part that's always bothered me.
Craig, in your book, you say bank accounts have become a lose-lose investment in which either you lose a little, a lot, or everything. And like a casino, your bank gives you zero hope or chance of winning big. You warn that most bank accounts today pay a negative return. Can you explain this?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct, Michael. Bank accounts today pay a negative rate of return. And most people, when you say that, they say, no, I get my statement. It's low, but it paid me 1%. No, it's paying you a negative rate of return. Let me show you how. Even by the best estimates that the government has, we are running about 2.5% to 3% inflation. And that's being optimistic. I happen to believe it's a lot higher than that. Well, if you're being paid 1% interest on the money that's sitting in the bank account, and inflation is running 3%, you are guaranteed a negative 2% return. It's referred to as financial repression, and we'll get into that later in the conversation. It's a device that's been used in economics for years, and most people don't even realize it's happening. And this is why it's so difficult for savers, especially retired people that are on fixed incomes, to be able to live off the money that they put away in the bank, hoping to live on the interest. Because how in the world do you live off a 0.5% or 1% interest return when your cost of living is going up 2% or 3%? And so at least in a casino, you have a shot. And I'm not encouraging, Michael, that the Savage Nation listener goes to a casino and starts gambling. That would not be my suggestion. But make no mistake about it, they probably have a better chance at a casino than they have in the banks, because banks today guarantee you a negative rate of return. Until we see interest rates that are paid to deposits and savers that is higher than the running rate of inflation, we have a negative rate return environment in our banking system. Once again, this is very positive for people who borrow huge amounts of money, like the federal government, the largest debtor in the world. Very negative towards people that work hard, save, put their money away in the bank because they don't want to take the risks that are associated with real estate or stocks or bonds or any other investment, gold, silver. Look, every investment has risk. And so we've got to keep in mind that the old days of being able to say putting your money in the bank is safe, well, that saying, Michael, just doesn't work anymore.
Craig, has this Fed policy of negative interest rates, also known as financial repression, now created market bubbles everywhere? And why do you think so few people are taking action to protect themselves?
While we're on the subject, let's talk about what financial repression really means, okay? Because financial repression, in simple terms, when your rate of return on your deposit is lower than your rate of inflation, you are losing money. It traditionally forces people to leave deposits, the safety of deposits in a bank, and go into more risky assets looking for return. You either go into stocks, bonds, again, something that will give you a rate of return. Well, what happens as a direct result of that is all this money goes rushing into, let's say, the stock market. Well, this will create a bubble. We saw this happening in the housing market. Years ago, when we had low interest rates for an extended period of time, you basically could go out and get a mortgage with no qualifications. They used to call them ninja loans, no income, no job, no asset. As long as you could breathe, you could get a mortgage. And what happens is that money all goes into, let's say, the stock market, for example. Well, that makes share prices go up. As a direct result of that, it doesn't mean those corporations have more prospects of making more money in the future. It just means there's more buyers than there's sellers. Same thing with the housing market. There were more buyers than there were sellers. So inventory shrank, prices went up. And next thing you know, when there were more sellers all of a sudden and there were buyers, the housing market started crashing. And that's why you have some people that are out there. You can find people like James Rickards, Steve Forbes, or many of them. Matter of fact, Jim Rickards says that you could see a 70% drop in the stock market right now because of the bubble that's being formed in the stock and bond market. And I personally believe that we see a huge bubble being created in the debt market, in the government debt markets, because think of the amount of capital that the government is taking out of the private sector in order to finance deficit spending. And in order to pay the we have at least $17 trillion that's been sucked out of the private sector to fund the government's national debt. So, you know, right there you are creating a bubble in government debt. Now, why do so many people not recognize this and not respond to it? Well, some of that would call for speculation on my behalf, but I think part of it is because people tend to trust what they see on television. They trust what their brokers tell them. They believe that America is great, which it will, and one day that, you know, the stocks will be higher than they were today and everything goes up forever. Unfortunately, that's not the case if you look at it historically. You got to remember, we're a relatively young country. We're only, you know, 240 years old. If you go back hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of years, you'll find out that there are many empires, if you will, superpowers like America, the Athenian Empire, the Roman Empire, the Ottoman Empire, the British Empire. I mean, we can go even back through some of the dynasties of China and see that there were huge amounts of wealth and huge amounts of power that were created. But unfortunately, when they got in over their heads with debt and credit and all these financial bubbles, if you will, it was only a matter of time before they lost status. And I'm convinced of this, Michael. We will lose our reserve currency status in the world. That means no longer will they have to trade in oil settled down in dollars. You know, you may see the Chinese using yuan to buy oil from Saudi Arabia, where typically before the Chinese would take yuan, they would buy U.S. dollars, and then they would buy oil with the dollars. And there's a lot of talk right now about the International Monetary Fund creating what's called an SDR, a special drawing right, or maybe even the yuan becoming gold-backed. I mean, there's just a lot of scenarios out there right now. So I think most people, because they don't understand it, they put trust in conventional wisdom. They just assume that ultimately it'll all work out over time. Unfortunately, this time it's not going to. It's worked well for the last, 60, 70 years. But if you adjust for inflation, it hasn't worked all that well because inflation continues to eat away the savings of many hardworking, decent Americans.
Craig, you write this because fractional reserve banking adds this risk of bank runs to the economy. It makes a society more vulnerable and unstable. It has the potential to turn every rumor or problem into a crisis. Are we now a crisisocracy? Could we really be at risk of a major bank run in America, Craig?
Well, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, Michael, but yes, I think we are at very serious and quite highly likely the chance of major bank runs in America. And banks are bracing for this. I mean, I can show you headlines sitting right next to me on my desk. U.S. banks brace for large deposit outflows. They're getting ready for a run on the banks. And we're already starting to see capital controls. We talk about this in our book. If you want to do your own stress test, go to your local bank and try to cash a check for $8,000 or $9,000 or $10,000 in cash and see what type of runaround you'll get from your local banker. I could show you currency controls that are clearly in place with money market funds now. The SEC recently just passed a rule that says that they can actually delay the redemption of a money market fund. They can penalize you for taking money out of a money market fund, actually cause you a charge. So yes, we're clearly at high risk of a major run on the banking system. And here's the problem. If we were on a solid banking system, say a gold-backed banking system, it wouldn't be a problem. But we're on a fractionalized banking system. We refer to it in the book as a fractured banking system. In so much as that you put $1 in the bank, they create $10 worth of credit, that becomes $10 worth of debt. So just imagine, if you will, let's say a depositor puts $100,000 in the bank. That banker goes out and makes 10 loans for $100,000 apiece. And now all of a sudden, you need your $100,000 back out. Well, to quote old George Bailey from It's a Wonderful Life, your money's in Jim's home and Joan's home and Harry's home and Pete's home. And you can't get those people to sell their homes overnight in order for you to get your money back out. So banks have to keep a certain amount of capital on hand so that they can deal with those eventualities. Well, the banks are so stretched right now, and capital requirements, in my opinion, are so small for the too-big-to-fail banks. And people say, well, wait a minute, we increased those capital requirements under Basel III, and we increased them under Dodd-Frank. Yes, but not enough that if we had a major run on the banks that it would stop people from cashing out, Michael. And so my big concern is that when people start withdrawing money from the system, and we wrote about this in our book called The Great Withdrawal, our last book prior to Don't Bank on It, when you start seeing a cascading effect of people taking their money out of the banks, money has to be put in from somewhere. Well, the last time, guess what? The federal government put in the money. The Federal Reserve created $3.1 trillion, increasing their balance sheet to over $4 trillion to put money into the banking system. This time it's clear, looking at the memorandums that we've signed with the Bank of England and discussions we've had with systemically important financial institutions referred to as SIFIs, with IMF and the Bank of International Settlement, we're going to see bail-ins this time versus bailouts. And that's why I'm very, very concerned that banking runs could have a domino effect, a cascading effect. You know, just because $1 comes out, we're going to see it exponential. People think, well, hey, if I have a $100 million bank, it'll be more vulnerable than the $1 trillion bank. I think just the opposite. And that's why I've called for a breaking up of the big banks. I think the too big to fail banks, Michael, have become bigger. They're 37% bigger. They have larger derivative exposures. So runs on the bank, if they happened today, would be far worse than they were in 2008. And so, yes, I'm very concerned about it. And the fractional banking system makes things exponentially worse than if we were on a straight banking system where you could only lend out what you had in capital to lend out.
Bank shocker number one on page 65 of Don't Bank on It, you write, when you deposit money into a fractional reserve bank, the bank actually becomes the de facto owner of an unsecured loan or asset that you have given it, the receipt or passbook that you walk away with and think of as evidence of your bank account is actually an IOU. How is this possible? Please explain to America how it is that our money suddenly becomes the bank's money. Under new international agreements and laws, Craig, this is frightening.
Your money, when you put it in a bank, becomes the bank's money. If you don't believe me, if you go to the bank and they won't give you your money for whatever reason, they own it. You don't own it. And we did extensive study. Not only did we find English law about this, but we also found comments, and we wrote about it in our last book, The Great Withdrawal. We quoted Ellen Brown, who is the chair of the Public Banking Institute, in her analysis of what we've signed with the Bank of England and the FDIC. And I quote her, although few depositors realize it, legally the banks own the depositors' funds. As soon as they are put in the bank, our money becomes the bank's. And we become unsecured creditors holding bank IOUs or promises to pay. That's exactly right. And I can cite you case law, like in the case of Edward Thomas Foley versus Thomas Hill. And it goes back into the 1800s, but the principles remain the same throughout the years. You know, it's kind of like if you give me your keys to your car, you still own the car, but I have possession of it. So your car's safety is really in my hands. And the same thing with a bank deposit. When you put your money in that bank, it depends upon how stable and secure the bank is. And so most people don't realize that. Now, here's my big concern. In all the Dodd-Frank legislation and these agreements we've signed with international banks and the Banks of International Settlement and the IMF and the Bank of England, they all talk about shareholders, bondholders, and unsecured creditors. Well, we know clearly who the bondholders are. That's a pretty simple thing. They bought the bonds of the bank that financed the bank, for Pete's sakes. We know who the shareholders are. These are people that bought shares of the bank that are the capital that's used to run the bank and hopefully pay a dividend if it's a dividend paying stock. But who are the unsecured creditors? The unsecured creditors are the depositors. And now the discussions are of bail-ins versus bail-outs. In other words, let's say your bank goes down. Traditionally, the government would come in and bail it out. Well, now what they'll do is your money will be the money that's held in the bank, and that money will be used to get the bank out of trouble. Now, does that mean you'll never get your money? No. No, you'll get your money, but it may take some time to get your money because according to the Bank of England and the FDIC agreement, it says that you'll be given shares. In the case of Cyprus banks, they guaranteed the first 100,000 euro, but beyond that, you actually lost 47% of your money by a discount. They actually gave you a haircut on your deposit. So don't think for 1 minute that we could not see this happen in America. The minute you put your money in a bank, you are subject to the whims of that bank. I was talking to a friend about this the other day. You know, a lot of people do their banking online. Imagine if you would, that you had $700 in the bank and you went to pay all your bills and you sent this much to this guy and this much to this guy and you went online. And all of a sudden, the emails started coming back. I'm sorry, there's not enough money to cover this. So you call your bank and you say, wait a minute, I have $700 in the bank. And the bank teller that you speak to over the phone says, no, I'm sorry, we only show $70 in the bank. Well, you say to the banker, there must be a mistake because I clearly have $700. And you have this discussion, you grab your last statement, you go down to the bank, and the bank says, Mr. Savage, all we show in your bank account is $70. We can't make good payments on this. Well, you call the police. They can't do anything. It's a civil issue. What do? You end up having to call an attorney. I mean, you can't just jump over the counter and grab your $700 because your $700 doesn't exist in a bank vault anymore. It now exists in a computer system, a very elaborate computer system, I might add, a very vulnerable computer system, I might add. And again, it's not like this has never happened. You've heard about it time and time again about how somebody's had $10 million deposited in their bank account by mistake, or how somebody's statement was messed up. Now, most of the time, it is just a glitch and it is straightened out. But don't kid yourself to believe that your money is not at risk sitting in a bank, because it is. Now, people are going to say, well, wait a minute, Craig. I put that $1,000 check in the bank, and it may belong to the bank, but if that bank goes under, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation is insured me that they will pay that $1,000 back up to $250,000. You're absolutely correct. And to the extent that the FDIC has enough money to pay you on that deposit, then you're in good shape. But right now, the FDIC has less than $1 to cover every $14 worth of deposits. Now, again, it's kind of like car insurance. Not everybody wrecks their car on the same day, so the car insurance companies play the actuaries, Michael. And what they do over the long term is they look at how many people crash a car on a yearly basis, and they figure it out accordingly. Well, what if one bank after the next started going out of business? The FDIC funds would be depleted in a matter of moments. I'm not talking hours or days now. I'm talking a matter of moments. We have about $68 billion on hand at the FDIC, along with another backup of a little less than $0.5 trillion. For $9 trillion worth of cash deposits, not counting some of the other deposits. That being said, that $0.5 trillion would run out rather quickly. And that's why people who say, oh, I'm protected. Well, they're right. If just your institution goes out of business, you're in good shape. As long as your institution isn't J.P. Morgan or your institution isn't Bank of America. You know, a J.P. Morgan that has 2.5, 2.6, 2.7, given the day, $1 trillion worth of assets, deposits with $69 trillion worth of derivatives against it. You may think you're safe, and you may feel you're safe, but that little sticker on the front door that says FDIC will take care of you, tell that to the people in late 1980s, early 1990s, who used to see the same sticker that said FSLIC. The Federal Savings and Loan Insurance Corporation was designed to protect the savings and loans. Now, ultimately, the good news is everybody got their money. But in some cases, it took as long as 6 to 8 months to get their money. So you got your money, but what did you do in the meantime if you had needed that money?
Bank shocker number two. The FDIC could only ensure the safety of about 7% of private U.S. bank accounts in a major financial crisis. You know what this means? Only $1 in $14 on deposits in banks is covered by FDIC insurance. So it looks to me like we have fractional reserve banks that are backed up by fractional reserve insurance, correct? Doesn't the FDIC have to publicly disclose this?
You know, which is interesting, Michael. The FDIC hasn't publicly disclosed this. And I'm surprised that they haven't. I'm surprised that they're not forced to by the Dodd-Frank legislation. But again, and you know me, I'm not a conspiratorial nut. I don't look for black helicopters and wear tinfoil hats. But I got to tell you something. I believe if the American people knew that there was this thin of insurance coverage, you probably wouldn't see very many people in the banks, and that would create a problem in and of itself. If you knew that ABC Insurance Company could only pay out one of every 14 claims that they got in, say, auto insurance, would you buy a policy from a company like that? I think lack of transparency that we have on behalf of the FDIC is quite frankly embarrassing, and it's just not right for the American people, because I'm convinced when the American people are told the truth, they'll make proper decisions and they can take care of themselves. Unfortunately, especially in this current administration, they believe the government knows everything and they know better for you than what you know for you.
Banks, shocker number three. Did you know bank deposits are always welcome, but each day becomes harder to withdraw your own money? Did you know that? You write this. Banks are now required to report any withdrawal of $10,000 or more and any unusual or suspicious financial activity by any customer to the federal government, page 219. So are we all criminal suspects now just because we need to withdraw cash for a holiday or to make a large cash purchase? It sure sounds like they've criminalized us.
Boy, it sure does sound like it, doesn't it, Michael? Matter of fact, I saw an article the other day where this little lady who ran a Mexican food restaurant had her account frozen because she was putting in, you know, her daily deposits into the account, and they thought she was up to no good, so they just froze her account. This actually started around 1986. Banks are required to report any withdrawal of $10,000 in cash. And now they've extended it even to, quote, unusual or suspicious financial activity by any customer to the federal government. So I guess now when you bank outside of the normal electronic banking or the normal writing the check or the normal using your debit card, if you just go to a bank and want to pay your bills in cash, I guess there's almost an aura, if you will, Michael. You must be up to no good if you need cash or you're coming in for a bank draft. We've had report after report of people who have literally been put through the third degree. You know, what are you doing with this money? I love the story about Mr. Cotton over at HSBC Bank, where he walked in and wanted to pull out £14,000, and they put him through the third degree. A client of the firm couldn't get a check cash for $10,000, had to go to four different branches because they didn't have $10,000 cash in one particular bank, and it's a very well-known bank. And we even cite examples of this of a friend of mine who actually went to cash a check for $25,000. And they wanted to know why she wanted the money. How was she going to use the money? I mean, quite frankly, these are no business of the banks. Now, if we fill out the proper paperwork and we're going about our business, we should not be disturbed. We're the land of the free, the home of the brave, for Pete's sakes. We should be assumed to be playing by the rules, not breaking the rules. And yet now it seems to be that if you go to a bank to take your money out of their bank, you're suspected to being up to no good.
Let's talk about the emerging cyber threats of modern banking. On page 15, you write, Jesse James today could not steal your savings or identity, yet hackers and cyber warriors might be able to rob you within milliseconds from the far side of the world. China has 125,000 full-time cyber warrior hackers planning an electronic Pearl Harbor that could bring down the West. Did you hear this? Are we really that vulnerable?
Cyber threats to our banking system right now are unprecedented. China alone has 125,000 full-time cyber warriors hacking away at our system, looking for, as you said, another Pearl Harbor. Keep in mind the terrorists on 2011. You know, they didn't try and attack our shores and take over California or New York City. They attacked our financial systems. They know we have too great of a military to take us down militarily. They are attempting to take us down financially. And then when I read that 76 million accounts at JP Morgan Chase were attacked by cyber hackers, and the scary part about it is that JP Morgan can't tell you how they got in. They can't tell you what information they took. They can't tell you how they got out, nor can they tell you whether they left any doors to get back in. And then a couple days after that, we found out that a total of 83 million households were attacked during that week alone. We're talking about brokerage firms. We're talking about banking concerns. Heck, we've all heard about the hacks at Target and Kmart and all these other organizations that have been hacked. You've seen some of the best .com companies in the world have had computer attacks. Heck, they've taken the Apple website down a couple times. So what we're concerned about is not that they can just take your money, but also concerned about that they can scramble the data. Let's go back a couple questions ago where I talked about you say you have 700 in the bank, they say you have 70 in the bank. Well, if a hacker has gone into that system and created chaos, and he's taken Mr. Jones' account and swapped the balances for Mr. Burns' account, and he took Mr. Burns' account and swapped those balances for Mr. Smith's account, and the bank doesn't know who has what, all the money could be there. But the bank's going to have an impossible job at trying to get you your right amount of money. And cyber attacks are a huge vulnerability. Look, let's face facts. The banking system today is easier to use than ever. You've got ATMs, you've got online banking, you've got bank by mail. I mean, very seldom people ever even go to the branch anymore, for Pete's sakes. It's so convenient. They've got new PayPals and Apple Pay and Currency and Square, all these other entities where you just swipe the card and you're on your way. And that convenience is wonderful, but with that convenience comes huge vulnerability. Now, getting back to the JP Morgan Chase hack, we now found out that those were Russian cyber attackers that were coming in. We run websites here at the firm, and our sites are constantly under attack. Everything you do online, the banks can see. And even if you don't do them online, they talk to each other. The banks talk to each other about that same information. So, yes, we are really that vulnerable, Michael. And that's why I wrote this book.
Hey, Craig, let's talk about the cashless society. You write that if Jesse James today tried to rob a modern bank in Sweden where they already are 97% cashless, he'd be out of luck. As we plunge into the cashless society, banks as we have known them will begin to vanish. Soon, your cell phone or tablet will be your bank, holding your electronic wallet. Holy God. So in the near future, are banks and paper money doomed to extinction?
It's interesting, Michael, when you look at it. We've been in a cashless society for, I would argue, almost 20 years now, and cash is becoming less and less and less. Matter of fact, the modern banking system in Sweden is virtually 97% cash-free and soon will be 100% cash-free. Our cell phones, our tablets, we all bank on those. We carry electronic wallets now. Yes, the banks and paper money are doomed to extinction. They are no longer going to be viable. That's why it's so critical, in my opinion, that you have something that you physically, tangibly hold in your hand that represents money that is not a dollar bill. It's like a stock and bond. Many people don't realize, unless you've asked for private ownership of that stock in your stock account, it's held by the brokerage firm. It's not segregated into your name. Let's say you have $100,000 in the stock market and you took $10,000 out and you bought gold coins or silver coins. You physically hold them in your hands. You don't have to depend upon a computer or a teller at a bank or anything. You physically hold those coins. And that's why we are imploring the American public to start rethinking your financial position to include a physical position of gold and silver coins. It's going to be critical. We go into the book in great detail about the Carrington event, which is now referred to as the Carrington effect, that happened in 1859. It was a sunspot that took 17 hours to get to Earth and basically wiped out our telegraph systems. I mean, we've had some sunspots now that if they hit the Earth, they could literally fry every printed circuit and every computer that we have here on Earth. I mean, it could take down our power grid. What would you do in a situation like that? But if in the closet, you know, hid behind the dirty socks, you had a bag full of silver dollars or a handful of gold coins, you'd be able to get through that. And so, yes, I think that banking is going through a huge metamorphosis. I think Dodd-Frank was horrible legislation, and it's going to have to be completely redone. It was, once again, knee-jerk reaction to a problem. No different than the Affordable Care Act, which we're finding out is not affordable and it's going to provide you less care. That's going to have to be revamped. We're going to have to start getting away from dependence on government doing the right thing, because we've known now for well over 100 years, it started, in my opinion, in 1912, ever since the first openly liberal politician, Woodrow Wilson, took office, they thought bigger government and more government was better government. What did Woodrow Wilson do in 1913? He passed the Federal Reserve Act, putting a central bank into place, which our founding fathers just fought against tooth and nail. We then passed the 16th Amendment for federal income tax. Then Mr. Roosevelt comes along and starts all these welfare projects and get back to work projects and recalls gold. And then Mr. Lyndon Johnson puts it on steroids. We've now spent, what, close to $10 or $12 trillion on the war on poverty, and people are worse off today than before. We're getting ready for a revamping. And look, it's going to be painful, but the outcome is going to be great because we're going to get away from government to run the financial system. We should have businesses running the financial system. Now, I know you all, or some people are going to say, oh, you're talking about the big fat cat bankers. No. I'm talking about the people. I'm talking about you and I. We should keep our money in banks that are going to pay us a return. We should buy stocks that are good, solid companies that are not taking pot shots at the moon. We need to be involved in our money. And we've gotten to a place in America where the average person works hard. They put their money into the broker. They just trust the broker's doing the right thing, or they put it into the bank, trusting the bank's doing the right thing. And then if they don't, that the government's going to punish them. Name me one person that had handcuffs put on them for 2008. Name me one big banker that got us in trouble, that billions of dollars of taxpayers' money bailed them out, that went to court. The answer is zero, my friend. And the reason for that is because of the incestuous relationship, and we talk about this in the book, between the banks and the banking system and our politicians. Politicians create laws, the banks live with them, then the banks take campaign contributions, give them back to the banks, and it's just a revolving door. And if you've noticed recently, J.P. Morgan, a $15 billion fine. Bank of America, a $14 billion fine. And they act like it's nothing. They write the check like, okay, it's just a cost of doing business. When we can see a combined $50, $60 billion a year worth of fines being imposed on our banks by the federal government, and they shake it off as if it's no big deal, don't kid yourself for one minute that they're not getting that money back in spades from other entities.
In the future, instead of major bank bailouts, you say the next stage is bail-ins. Will U.S. taxpayers be on the hook either way? Please explain what you mean by this.
Yes, this time the taxpayers will be on the hook again, Michael, but not in the same way. And what I mean by that is that we won't have taxpayer dollars bailing out the money. We will have taxpayers who paid their taxes on the money they deposited in the bank be the deposits to save the bank. In other words, your money will be held in the bank, and that money will be used as capital to keep the bank going until the bank can become profitable again. And so one way or another, if you're depending on the U.S. banking system to do anything more than to pay your bills on a monthly basis, you are running the risk that your money could be held up. Now, I want to be clear about this, Michael. I ultimately believe you will get your money back, but it will take some amount of time. And during that time, what happens if the Federal Reserve creates trillions and trillions and trillions of more dollars and continue to devalue the U.S. dollar? Yes, we have had a respite in our decline in the U.S. dollar. Recently, the U.S. dollar has been the best of the worst, if you will. Our currency is the strongest of all the currencies that are out there right now, but not on a long-term basis. If you look at the U.S. dollar on a long-term chart, the trend on the U.S. dollar is down. Everybody knows it. About the only thing that's costing you less today than it did yesterday is gasoline, because we've seen the price of oil come down. Not because of government, but because of private industry drilling on private property, bringing more product to the market. Not because of the government has opened up big amounts of property or have given oil depletion allowances. No, because American enterprise has gone out and got more oil. But everything else is going up in price. Beef hit a 40-year high the other day. Milk, eggs, your electric, I go right through the gamut. Health insurance premiums are up. College tuitions are up. Car insurance is up. The cost of a new automobile is up. Your U.S. dollar is losing value every single day, and we all know it. It's kind of like this ridiculous claim that we're at 5.7% unemployment. If you just put in the 90 million people that have given up looking for work, what's referred to as the participation rate, and bring it back to trend or the normal number, we would have about 18% unemployment today. And that's why when I hear this administration talk about how much better things are, they're not better. They look good on the stock market, but you show me the average American family. Their income is down year over year. They've lost 10% of income over the last 6 years. They haven't gained 10% in income. Their wages are dropping. They're working more hours to make less money. They're working more jobs because people can only find part-time jobs because of the Affordable Care Act. So let's not try and kid ourselves to believe that this short-term rebound in the U.S. dollar means a long-term prosperous America. It just doesn't.
Hey, look, the Fed appears to be trapped in a zero-interest, zero-incentive world of its own creation. You write this, by flooding banks with money conjured out of thin air, the Fed has put banks in a liquidity trap. And by keeping interest rates near zero, the Fed has given near zero incentive to lenders, including savers, who have lent their deposits to banks. This has impaired genuine investment capital formation, hiring, and economic growth. Can reforming the banking and monetary system really get our economy growing and creating new jobs again? Is that real?
Yes, Michael. Yes, yes, yes. If we were to reform our banking and monetary systems tomorrow, we would see job creation like we've never seen in the history of this nation. That's the beautiful part about when we wrote the book. We realized where the problems were. If we were to just put proper reforms into place, and I'm not talking about government reforms, I'm talking about less regulations and more market controls into place, if you will. See, markets are very self-governing. Because they know that if you don't do the proper thing, you're going to lose clients and ultimately you'll be out of business. It may take longer than government regulations, but it ultimately happens. If we were to go back to a gold standard, and you've heard a lot about that recently, the best years of this country could be ahead of us. If we just broke the incestuous relationship between the banks and the politicians, we'd see great growth come back. If we saw government regulation get out of the way of business, look, you're seeing it in North Dakota and South Dakota. Where on private lands, they only have so much they can do. Look at what's happening. We're not destroying the environment, and we're becoming energy independent. We're producing more oil now than Saudi Arabia. Most people forget. Go back 30 years ago in this country, and we were producing more oil than Saudi Arabia. That's the greatest part, is that when you read our book, you'll realize that with proper banking reforms, and getting away from fractionalized banking and a Federal Reserve that is not federal and has no reserves is taken out of the equation. You say, Craig, you should abolish the Fed. Yes, absolutely. The Fed, in my opinion, does more to harm this economy than to help this economy. They try and take the bumps out of the economy. Ever since they've been put into place, they've made it worse. I can go back and show you economic event after economic event all through the 1800s. They lasted 2 years, sometimes only 18 months. Look at this last economic event we had, 2008. It's taken 6 years and we're still recovering. Look at 1929. We had a Federal Reserve that jumped in. It took 11 years and a Second World War in order to straighten out the mess. Every time the Federal Reserve has gotten involved in manufacturing a quote-unquote prosperous economy, they've made things worse. And that's why you even see Alan Greenspan himself going back to the paper he wrote in 1967 saying the gold standard would be good because it would make people be honest. You wouldn't be able to go out and gamble with other people's money. And so, yes, yes, yes. If we reformed the banking and monetary system, we would have growth and job creation like no other nation. And what comes as a direct result of that? Higher incomes for families, more tax revenues. If we can hold government spending where it is or really try and hold it down to the rate of inflation, you could over the next 10 years pay off the national debt, get us back to a balanced budget, make government do what it was supposed to do, and that's protect the American people, secure our borders, and make sure that they work for the common good of the people, the common safety of the people, we could have the best years of this nation's whole history ahead of us. But we've got to break the strangle that a handful of banks, I mean, I don't think most people realize it. The five major banks now have such a concentration of wealth that it's unprecedented. Those banks count for hundreds of trillions of dollars worth of derivative exposure. The Bank of International Settlement, by the way, that's the central bank of the central bankers. They say now that it's $710 trillion worth of derivative exposure right now. That's almost a quadrillion dollars. We haven't had a trillion seconds of time that have passed since Adam and Eve walked in the Garden of Eden. I mean, these numbers are staggering, but it has to be dealt with.
Hey, look, Craig, I want to leave our listeners with some hope for the future and alternative solutions. You write, in America today, almost no enterprise is more regulated than banking, and every regulation is one more pressure point, choke point, that can be pressed to extort from banks whatever progressive politicians desire. So is a big part of the solution to sweep failed progressive politicians out of office?
They believe that government can do things better than the private sector. They believe that progressives have the solutions to every problem. That if you weren't breastfed as a kid, they need to build a school for kids that weren't breastfed. Or if you live in a certain part of town, you're disadvantaged. No, they need to realize that the American people are hardworking, we're smart, and we just want a fair shot. And quite frankly, the government more than once has stacked the deck for special interests. And I'm talking about all special interests. I'm not just talking about the big banks or the unions or a particular racial group or religious group or the left or the right. There's always favorites that are played in Washington, D.C., and make no doubt about it that that occurs. But when we were a nation who believed one nation under God, indivisible. And Michael, I hate to steal this from you, but because you created this and you birthed this saying 25 years ago, borders, language, and culture. When we all believed in wanting to be Americans, not hyphenated Americans. I'm not a German American or an African American or a Japanese American. I'm an American. Okay, when we got away from this identity politics, we built the greatest nation. I mean, do you really think during the Second World War, people were looking at each other's religion or ideological background when we were building bombs and tanks to fight the Nazis? Come on. And that's why I think American exceptionalism is our future. I believe that we have the greatest nation that the world has ever seen. And that's why in the back of my book, we put solutions, the 19 solutions that we propose, the 19 solutions you should look for, and the things that you should do personally to minimize your risks, not just to help the country, but to minimize your personal risks. Because you have to understand that we, the people, are the government.
Despite all the problems, you appear to have a deep belief Americans will find some way to get off this financial Titanic before it sinks, in part due to American exceptionalism. Here's what you write. Most of our ancestors pulled up roots in their original homelands and came here in search of freedom and the right to earn and own property. American exceptionalism exists, in part, because we are a self-selected nation whose people carry the genes of brave pioneers who moved here for religious and economic liberty. Wow. It will take exceptional faith in an exceptional God to help us find a way out of this big government and banking mess. Craig, give us a few solutions that you propose in your book.
Government doesn't make anything. You make something. You go out. You create wealth through your labor. You pay taxes on it. That tax goes to the government. That government uses that money, hopefully for good. They build roads. They do research. They build a military. They keep you safe so you don't have to worry about a bomb dropping on your head at night. Okay, but that's what they should be doing. The rest of it, we should be doing. The rest of it, we should be involved. You know, you'll say to me, please propose some solutions. Well, read the book. It'd take me 2 hours to give you every single solution that we have in the book. Okay, but I can tell you what you need to do personally. Personally, you need to reduce your debt. You need to diversify your holdings. Now is a time to put your money in something that's tangible. Not all your money, but a portion of your money. Have some of your money in stocks, some of your money in bonds, some of your money in cash and real estate, maybe even mutual funds, money markets. But also have a good portion of your money in gold and silver coins that you physically own.
Okay, so part of the solution is preparation and asset diversification. That is answering the what ifs before they happen. And you write this, What would happen to our business if the government suddenly ordered your bank to cut you off from all financial services, including bank lines of credit, even though you had broken no law? That's a tough one. Should we have multiple bank accounts, offshore banking, bitcoins, barter networks, put ourselves on a personal gold and silver standard? What would you say?
And look, I could take hours going through the benefits of owning tangible assets, the potential ability to be able to pass on to future generations your wealth and to be able to leave a legacy. And look, I'm convinced sooner or later, we're going to go back to gold that has been around for 2,000 years as our form of money. You have to ask yourself a question. Why is all the money, i.e. gold, because that's ultimate money, why has it all been moving east? Why is China building vaults that will store 14 to 20,000 tons of gold? Why is Germany asking the Federal Reserve to take the gold that they're storing for them at Fort Knox and ship it back to Germany? Why are the central banks, whether the price has been 1,800, 1,100, 1,500, buying gold systematically every single quarter? Why? Because they know that the money system, the way that it's designed, which is basically like an inverted pyramid, the tip is the base and the wide part of it is the top. We're going to topple one direction or the other. Does it mean it's going to be the end of the world? Of course not. We've survived worse than this. We've survived civil wars. We've survived revolutionary wars. We've survived the War of 1812. We've survived the First and Second World War, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, the Desert Storms, the war in Afghanistan and Iraq. I mean, this country is a great country, but the money system has got, for a lack of a better term, a virus. And that virus cannot be contained anymore. It's just too far out of control. I can't wait for you to read our book because we take it in very simple bites so that you can understand it. And let me tell you something. When you have somebody like Warren Buffett, who's a brilliant man, tell you he'd like to have somebody explain to him how a derivative works and that a derivative is what he refers to as a financial weapon of mass destruction. And how somebody like Jamie Dimon, who runs the largest bank in America, cannot really explain a derivative but owns $70 trillion worth of them. You tell me how secure we should feel about our system. Well, I can tell you how much gold was mined in the world. I can tell you who owns the gold. I can tell you how gold has been traded through wars and famines and prosperity and depressions and recessions and inflations and deflations. And I can show you how it's gotten through all those times. And the price fluctuates up and the price fluctuates down. The price has fluctuated down recently because the dollar's been stronger. Well, guess what? If you were in a balanced portfolio, that's great. One part of your portfolio went up, a small part of your portfolio went down. You're balanced, you're hedged, you're insured. And I'll leave you with this analogy. I don't know about you, but I would never think, Michael, to drive my automobile without automobile insurance. Now, when I pay that premium every year, that $1,500 or whatever it is a year in premium, do I buy that premium and say, boy, I sure hope I wreck my car by the end of the year, because if I don't wreck my car by the end of the year, I didn't get my money's worth. No, I hope I never need to use it. I would wish Americans would start looking at gold that way. I wish they'd get away from this, just looking at it as a great place to make money, because it has been. Gold has quadrupled over the last 12 years. But I wish they could see it for what it really is. It's an insurance policy. It's a hedge of protection against an uncertain future. And most people don't know this. I guess I'm laying this out, Michael, in a kind of a private conversation. Do you know that I have never personally, for an ounce of gold or an ounce of silver that I have bought personally for my holdings, have ever sold it? In other words, I have silver dollars that I bought when I was a young man for $18. I have coins that are worth, that I paid $18 for, that are worth $130, $140 a piece. I've never once sold one. And people say, well, why didn't you? Because at one time they were worth $150. Because I don't buy gold and silver to try and make money. I buy gold and silver to preserve my money. I look at myself as a Will Rogers investor. I'm not so concerned about the return on my money as I am about the return of my money. When I started this firm 32 years ago out of the bedroom of my home with $50, I never thought in a million years that it would become the size company with 50,000 clients and the reach that we have. And I'm very proud of that. And the spokespeople, like fine people like you, Michael, and all the others throughout the years who've endorsed our company and used our firm. I never thought, but every dollar that we made here, we put a percentage away, we donated a percentage away, and we made sure that whatever we held on to after we paid our taxes and all, that it was hedged with real money. Has that hedge fluctuated up and down? You bet. But guess what? We've never needed to use it. And I hope I never need to. I hope we fix all these problems. That's why we write these books. That's why Lowell and I do interviews at 3 o'clock in the morning and late in the evening and early in the morning. Because we hope to head this off. But if we don't, our company is going to be prepared. And I'll say this in closing. You know, I've watched in the 35 years I've been involved in the gold and silver and coin business, I've watched a lot of people come and go. You know, I have a great associate broker that works here that says we have trees in our parking lot that are older than a lot of the coin companies out there. And I remember when some of these younger fellas were in diapers before they opened up their own companies. And there's nothing wrong with that. But at Swiss America, we know what it's like to go through good markets. We know what it's like to go through bad markets. And we understand that the client is everything. We understand that customer service is what's most important. We understand that in that moment that you need to sell and you need liquidity, that we're there to take care of it. When there's that crisis that hits and a loved one passes away and there's so many things that are going on and you need money, that we've simplified the process. We want our family to make sure that we take care of your family. And that's how we've built this business from myself and my wife, Melissa, 32 years ago. And now we've been married 37 years, working together, making sure that if we don't take care of the customer, somebody else will. And my dad gave me these great words when I first opened up Swiss America. He said, Craig, if you take care of the average client the way you would take care of me, the way you would take care of your mother or your sister or your brother, you'll have a very successful company. And always keep that in mind. And I have. And we do. And Dean Heskin and my oldest daughter, Holly, who now heads up our trust division, have that same ethic that the client comes first. And so I hope once you read the book and you draw the conclusion that you are going to need to get gold and silver in place in your portfolio, that you give us a call. You give us an opportunity to show you our services, whether it be in your 401k or in your IRA or in your physical holdings. You have my personal assurances that you'll be treated with the top-notch service that you can find in this country, that we will always be there for you. We pride ourselves on it. You know, I'm starting to get a little older now, and I can't work as many days a week as I used to like to. And now Dean has taken over, and Dean and Holly told me the other day, my daughter said, Dad, you know, you spent the first 32 years putting the foundation in a place, and now we'll build off that 32 years and we'll go another 32 years, and hopefully then my grandchildren will take over. I hope to have this be a firm that's like General Electric, that's been there for at least 100 years.
Craig, as always, it's both enlightening and frightening to discover just how unsafe the world of 21st century banking can be. Look, I know your suggestions have given me great food for thought and action to protect my money. Listeners of the Savage Nation, please take action today. A wise old saying goes like this: five birds are sitting on a wire, four decide to fly away to escape the danger of an approaching hawk. How many remain on the wire? Answer: five, because deciding to do something is not the same as actually doing it. Take action now. Call Swiss America at 800-289-2646 to discuss protecting your assets today. Craig Smith is as honest as they come. He's been a supporter of the Savage Nation from the get-go. He would walk through you nowhere to back me up. Until next time, this is Michael Savage saying, call Craig at 800-289-2646 to protect your assets.